All right, so this is Bio 160, and it is September 30th, and we have one more lecture before we got a test. So we're going to finish up skeletal system. We're going to just look at some bones today because you got some exam figures that you might have to label when you get to the test next time. So I'll tell you how to appreciate the human skeleton a little bit. Now, don't forget, I'm going to have office hours in anatomy lab on Thursday before the test. So if you want to come in and actually look at some bones, if you actually want to look at a skull, it may be helpful, but on the test, it's not going to be models or a real skull. It's going to be the figures that you have in your book or something very, very close to them. So it might help you if you study a lot between, like over the weekend, if you had studied, or between now and the test and you got time to come in. It might be helpful. But probably the most important thing is to actually look at those figures that are in your book. So last time we looked at a general long bone, the structure of a generalized long bone, right? Like this. And you know what the epiphysis is and the diaphysis and all that kind of stuff? What's the best way to say what the diaphysis of a bone is? That's the shaft. And the epiphysis, the elephant is going to fall down on me. Okay, those are the ends of the bone. Okay, the tips, you get the proximal and distal epiphysis. All right, and let's see, what else did we talk about last time? Oh, we talked about the osteon, which is the structural and functional unit of compact bone, solid bone in particular, right, compact bone. And what kind of cells, what kind of living cells are in bone? Osteocytes. And did we talk about the kind of cell that breaks bone down? Yeah, what's the name of a cell that breaks bone down? Is the osteoclast. And what's the kind of cell that builds bone up? The osteoblast, right? All right, so those are some things you should know. And this might be an exam figure, like you have to know these little pits are called lacunae. Maybe not so sure if this is an exam figure or not, but it's a really good figure to know because you see the osteocytes in there, you see the perforating canals and the central canal of the osteon. Okay, so I think we had gotten to where we were actually looking at maybe this slide right here, something like that. And that shows the whole skeleton in two different colors. And those two different colors are important because it shows the two major divisions of the skeletal system. The axial skeleton is made up of the bones of the head and the vertebral column, including the sacrum here and the little coccyx way down over here, as well as bones of the rib cage, which are formed by the ribs and this anterior bone of the thoracic cage, which is what we call the sternum. Right, so that's the axial skeleton. And then the other skeleton is in this yellow color right here. Is that yellow right there? Hopefully. Yeah. That's the appendicular skeleton. That's the appendicular skeleton made up of your appendages plus a couple other bones that help attach your appendages to your axial skeleton. And the bones that attach your appendages to your axial skeleton, we call them girdles. And it's easy to see. Yeah, it's easy to see with the pelvic girdle down over here made up of the hip bones, because what does girdle mean? Girdle means to, it means to actually surround and I suppose maybe hold in. If something is surrounding something, it might be holding it in. So we see a nice girdle that surrounds the lower trunk over here, but the pectoral girdle that holds the upper appendage to the axial skeleton really doesn't surround necessarily your whole upper trunk. Almost does, but not quite. Okay, so that's the major parts of the skeleton. So let's start looking at some of these bones. We also then talked about some landmarks on bones. Like what's the function of a process? Function of a process is? It is muscle attachment. That's right. So all of these are processes, and so their function is muscle attachment. A fossa, what's the function of a fossa? Where it's for holding something, right? And what is a foramen? It's a hole in a bone, and the function is for a passageway. It allows something to move through a bone. It could be a nerve, could be blood vessels, but probably In most cases, it's actually all three of those things. And then the condyle is a smooth articulating surface. All right, so let's start with the axial skeleton. It's starting with the skull. We got 28 bones. Some of these are paired bones, so you don't have 28 individual bones. The skull can be further characterized by bones that surround the brain. We call those cranial bones, as opposed to bones that make up the face. Those are what we call facial bones. And of all those bones, all those 28 bones in your head, there's only one that moves. Which one is that? That is your lower jawbone, and that is the mandible. That's right. Everyone else up there is stationary. All right, so let's just start looking at some of these bones of that make up the skull. All right, so this is almost fitting that we're talking about the skeleton in October, but it's not quite October yet. All right, so the bone that's right here in the front, that's what we call the frontal bone. And knowing bones well is very helpful in terms of anatomy, because when you learn bones, you learn a lot of vascular anatomy, you learn a lot of neuroanatomy, and since we're looking at the skull, we're going to actually learn a lot about the brain just by knowing bones. You have different parts of the brain, different lobes of the brain, right? And so, for instance, if this is the frontal bone right here, guess what lobe of the brain is right underneath the frontal bone? That's going to be the frontal lobe. So you automatically know a lot of stuff. The bone that's behind the frontal bone is the parietal bone. I'll show you another picture of where the parietal bone is, but it's right behind the frontal bone. So guess what? What lobe of the brain is in this region right here? Since that's the parietal bone, that's going to be the parietal lobe. All right, and then in this area right here, that's the temporal bone. Temporal bone is down right about here. Guess what lobe of the brain is here underneath the temporal bone? That's the temporal lobe right over here. Okay. All right, so those are some bones that make up the cranium that holds your brain in place. And then we see some facial bones here. And when I said the lower jawbone, that is for sure the mandible. And you can see your teeth are set into the mandible. There are little sockets that the teeth set into. Your upper jawbone is not the mandible. These are what we call maxilla. So each one is a maxilla here and here, and they have teeth. And then your cheekbone. Your cheekbones are what we call the zygomatic. So we got mandible, maxilla, zygomatic, and then up over here is the frontal. And on the bridge of the nose, those are what we call nasal bones. They're actually pretty small and pretty thin. All right, and then we see a nice separation between the nasal cavities. We call that the nasal septum. So a septum is anything that's like a little partition or a wall between different cavities in your body. So this septum is separating the right and left nasal cavity right here. It's made up of a couple bones. One is the ethmoid bone, and another is the vomer in this direction right over here. So sometimes in an anatomy class, you have to be able to say what bones make up the nasal septum. All right, so I think those are the bones that we can see pretty easily on this particular slide. So let's go to even a better view. Here's a better view. So this is probably not an exam figure, but that's a good place to start. But I think this one is an exam figure. Okay? So this one you got to know backwards and forwards. Everything on this particular slide right here. So again, where did we start? We started here. This is the frontal bone, and underneath the frontal bone is the frontal lobe, and here is the parietal bone. Underneath that is the parietal lobe, and then way in the back, posterior skull, that is the occipital bone, and the occipital lobe is underneath this one right here. So these are the major, huge bones that make up the skull. And then here is that smaller temporal bone. And okay, the lower jawbone, mandible, upper jawbone, maxilla. Here's the cheekbone, that is the zygomatic. All right, then here is the nasal bone. Now, between the zygomatic and the temporal bone, which is what we usually commonly refer to as our temporal region right there, that's really not the temporal bone. That is really the sphenoid. And the sphenoid is kind of an interesting bone because it goes all the way across from one side of the skull to the other. So if we look, and maybe you can see, what color is it? Hopefully it has the same color. It's kind of purple. You see any other purple bones in there? No? Great. Okay. Because where do you see purple? Is that purple right there? And there's some purple over here. Well, that sphenoid bone goes all the way across from one side of your head to the other. It's just one simple bone. It helps make up the posterior orbit. That's that hollow space where your eyeballs are. So let's see. That's a fossa for your eyeballs. So then you can see the sphenoid there. So the sphenoid is a very important bone. It helps make up that temporal region in your skull. It helps make up the eye socket. And it's also important because right smack in the middle, right here, which we can't see, there's a depression in the sphenoid bone that holds the pituitary gland. Anybody ever hear of a pituitary gland? Yeah, okay, very important gland. And it's held in position by the sphenoid, just in that location there. Okay, now what about some processes? I think we've learned about all the bones. All right, here is a process. We call it the styloid process because it kind of looks like a pen or a feather that people used to write with, you know, when they had an inkwell. So what's the function of this styloid process right here? Even without thinking, you should just automatically say muscle attachment, right? Any process, the function of any process is muscle attachment. Here is another big bony prominence. We call that the mastoid process. Guess what the function of the mastoid process is? Muscle attachment. We're going to learn some muscles that attach there too. Okay. So what else should I point out? Well, we got some foramina. Well, here's one. You don't have to know what it is. But that one's called the mental foramen. That's a passageway for nerves and blood vessels. But here is an interesting hole in the temporal bone. We call that the external auditory meatus. And that's what allows sound energy to enter your head because inside the temporal bone you have organs for hearing. And that's how the sound energy gets inside the temporal bone, through this external auditory meatus. And then lastly, probably some things that you should know are these joints between the bones of the skull. And these joints are fibrous joints. They're very stiff. They don't really allow for much motion at all. And so we call these sutures. These are fibrous joints or sutures. So here is the coronal suture because it's on the coronal plane. This one between the parietal and occipital is the lambdoidal suture. And the one between the temporal and the parietal bone, that's called the squamosal suture. Now, you kind of ran into that term once before. Squamous. What does squamous mean? It means flat. And as a matter of fact, this is the squamous region of the temporal bone because it is very flat. Right, the frontal bone has a lot of curvature, parietal has a lot of curvature, occipital has a lot of curvature. But those temporal bones are actually kind of flat, especially in this region right here. Okay, and then we have another process. This is a zygomatic process of the temporal bone. And this is the zygomatic, so it's moving back and articulating with the temporal bone. So we call that the temporal process of the zygomatic bone. So those are some important things. Oh, a couple other things. On the mandible, this process right here, coronoid process for muscle attachment. And then we have the mandibular condyle because that's part of the mandible. And the condyle is a part of a bone that's used for an articulation. So it's a smooth, rounded area, and it should have hyaline cartilage on there. And that makes a very important joint. All right, that we use all the time. I'm using it like crazy right now. You guys aren't. What joint is that? That's called the temporomandibular joint, otherwise known as TMJ. Temporomandibular joint is the TMJ. And a lot of people have problems with that joint. So what kind of doctor would you go talk to if you have problems chewing, maybe even problems sleeping, and it could produce migraines and all kinds of other different kinds of pathology? The TMJ, what kind of doctor would you go talk to? Okay, maybe a ear, nose, and throat, but probably a real good person would be also a dentist because they're involved with that whole oral cavity. Okay, so a dentist, your dentist might know more about that joint than most other kind of doctors. All right, so what else about this slide? I don't think much. I think we're kind of done with that slide right there. Okay. In the head, there are some large cavities in some bones. big empty spaces. And these empty spaces we call the paranasal sinuses. And you know what? I don't think I have this on your study sheet, but I'm going to just go over it really, really quick. So, for instance, this bone right here is the frontal bone, which is right about here. There's a big cavity in that frontal bone. One of the reasons why you have that cavity is because it makes the bone a lot lighter. So if all the bones in your head were solid, it would take a lot more energy, a lot more muscles just to hold your head up. So that's one reason. The other reason is that it's filled with lymphatic tissue that helps fight infection. So when we breathe air into our body, right, that helps fight bacteria that we're breathing in all the time. And that can get filled up with fluid as well and give you a runny nose, for instance. So that's one of the paranasal sinuses. In the sphenoid bone, see this area right here? This is where the pituitary gland sits, right there. Right underneath that is this big cavity, again, to help fight infection. So we call that the sphenoid paranasal sinus. In the maxilla, where's the maxilla at? Upper jawbone, right here. There are some big cavities as well, paranasal cavities to help fight infection. And then one bone we didn't talk about very much, but right smack in the middle of your face, right in this region right here, there's an ethmoid bone, and there are some sinuses in there. So the sinuses are in the frontal bone, the maxillary bone, the sphenoid bone, and the ethmoid bone. And these all help fight infection, unless they get chronically infected. And then I don't know what you're going to do. Okay, take a lot of antibiotics. And then every once in a while, I suppose if somebody has a really bad chronic infection, they actually go in and like rotor-rooter it out and suck all that material out. Okay, this is kind of a radical process, but that actually helps some people. Okay. On your list right here, I have six auditory ossicles. What does auditory mean? What sense do you think auditory refers to? Hearing. All right. So there are some really small bones. There are three on one side of your head, three on the other. And I can sort of give you an impression of where they are, but I can't show you them right at the moment. All right. So if we take the top of the skull off and look down into the compartment where your brain is, right, I can see the occipital bone in the back and the frontal bone in the front, temporal bones on the side. Right, remember, the part of the temporal bone that allows sound energy to enter your head. What was that? That was the external auditory meatus right here in the temporal bone. So let's now look inside the cranium in this direction. So here's the temporal bone. Right in this region here, right smack in the middle of the temporal bone, there are three little bones. And they're so small that I could have them between my fingertips right here, and you couldn't even see them. So I could tell you that I have the auditory ossicles right here, and you couldn't say, oh, no, you don't, because they fit. They would be hidden by my fingertips. They're inside the temporal bone, right about in this region right here. And they help allow you to, what, hear things, the auditory ossicles. And so anytime you hear that osteo or osseo, you should think of what? Like a bone. And these are for hearing. So when we get to senses, which is after the nervous system, I'll let you see what those auditory ossicles look like. And, oh, look what else we have right here. Is it purple? That's what you guys told me before. Purple? That is that sphenoid bone. And right here is that depression in the sphenoid bone that holds the pituitary gland. That's called the sella turcica. Now, this I don't think is an exam figure, but nonetheless, these are all interesting pictures to look at. Here is that ethmoid bone, right? And the ethmoid bone is right above the nasal cavity, and you can see a bunch of holes in it or a bunch of foramina. We call those olfactory foramina. And those are, what is the function of all these holes in that ethmoid bone right there? What's the function of a foramen? The function of a hole in a bone is, it's a passageway, right? And it's a passageway for olfactory nerves that go down into your nasal cavity, so that should maybe give you a sense of what the sense of olfaction is. What does olfaction mean? It really means a sense of smell. So that's how nerves for smell get into your nasal cavity through that part of the ethmoid bone. So the ethmoid bone is pretty interesting from that standpoint too. All right, well, let's move away from the skull and look at the vertebral column. So you have a lot of pictures in your book that show different views of the skull, but you don't have to really memorize those things. The hyoid bone. I don't know if I have a picture of the hyoid bone, but I can tell you where it is. All right, so here is a skull that's been cut right in mid-sagittal plane. And I can see what that little place for the pituitary. Here's the sphenoid sinus. Here's the frontal sinus. But right inside the mandible, tucked up in the mandible, is a little horseshoe-shaped bone that almost looks like a mandible, and it's the hyoid bone. And so you have many, many muscles, maybe 10 or 20 important muscles that attach to the hyoid bone that allows for articulation, and it allows for breathing, and allows for swallowing, and it helps so that when you breathe, you don't swallow at the same time, or when you swallow, you don't breathe at the same time, or so that you don't try and talk and swallow at the same time, because something bad is going to happen, like you're going to choke, right? So the hyoid bone is a bone that coordinates all those little muscles underneath inside your mandible for articulation, for speaking, and for breathing and swallowing. And it's a pretty delicate bone. It's surrounded by a lot of muscle, so I wouldn't suggest that you go and try and feel that palpate that particular bone. You can feel, you know, like your mandible and your frontal bone and bones in your appendages and things like that to help you remember where they are. But the hyoid bone, I'd kind of leave alone, because if you press hard enough to feel it, you know what? You might actually break it because it's such a dainty kind of bone. So don't mess with it. Don't tell your kids there's a bone in there, because what are they going to do? They're going to go digging around in there. Okay, so the hyoid bone would be about in this region right here, set inside the mandible, okay? And it's used for, like I said, for swallowing and articulation and things like that. Okay, vertebral column. Let's see if we can find the vertebral column. Did I talk about soft spots last time? I think I did, right? They're called fontanelles. All right, so here are those soft spots. Here's the anterior fontanelle. This is not an exam figure, but it just gives you a sense of where they are. Big one. This anterior is very large. Then we have a sphenoidal that's very close to the sphenoid. The mastoidal fontanelle is close to this mastoid process over here, and then the posterior fontanelle. So there are four major fontanelles in the neonate skull. Okay, and your book has another picture that shows them as well. Well, here we have the vertebral column. It's made up of vertebrae, which are bones. So let's just look at the whole vertebral column first, and then maybe look at an individual vertebrae to see what they look like. And you have vertebrae that make up your neck, you have vertebrae that make up your thorax, and you have vertebrae that make up your lumbar region below the thorax, and then in between your pelvic bones you have something called a sacrum. And then way down below that, you have a couple of vestigial bones that used to be tailbones, right, which we call the coccyx. Okay. So in the neck, you have 7 vertebrae. And in the neck, we call those cervical vertebrae. And usually we name vertebrae by their number from top to bottom or from superior to inferior position. And so here's cervical 1, here's cervical number 2, number 3, all the way down to number 7, cervical number 7. But usually we don't say cervical because it takes too long and we're always in a hurry. So what do we say? We just say C1, C2, C3, C4, right? And we just cover the whole neck in this region. All right, the next division are what we call thoracic vertebrae, and they're numbered from 1 down to number 12. But again, we don't say thoracic, we're just going to say T1, T2, T3, and you can count all the way down. All right, and then way down here, right above the sacrum, we have the lumbar vertebrae. And again, they're numbered 1 through 5, and we call them L1, L2, L3, L4, L5, from superior to inferior. So that's pretty easy to tell. Okay, so you have to know probably on the test how many vertebrae are in the cervical region, how many are in the thoracic region, and how many are in the lumbar region right here. And that's kind of easy to tell. I can tell you a little trick, unless you can memorize stuff real easily. And that is, right, by generally speaking, the time of day that you have breakfast and the time of day you have lunch and the time of day that you have dinner. So usually you wake up, have breakfast at 7 and you have lunch at, yeah, except on Tuesdays and Thursdays, okay, at noon, and you have dinner at 5. So you have 7 cervical, 12 thoracic, and 5 lumbar. And consequently, you have almost about 5 sacral vertebrae, but these are no longer individual vertebrae. They're what we call fused together. They've ossified together to form one structure. And you might have one more or one less sacral vertebrae. We call that anatomic variation within a population. That's no big deal, but there's usually about 5. And these little coccygeal vertebrae right here, can you see that there are a number of them in this region? Again, these, are fused as well. And there's a lot of variation in this region. It could be anywhere from 3 to 5. It all depends on who knows what. I'm not sure. Okay, it might be genetics, but it might be determined by other things too. All right, so don't forget, 7 cervical, 12 thoracic, and 5 lumbar. And I think that's probably good for right now, except that the first 2 cervical vertebrae have names all by themselves, besides C1 and C2. So let me show you what those sort of look like. Okay. I tell you what, I'm going to go back and just talk about a typical vertebrae first. So this is what a typical vertebrae looks like. This is the body of the vertebrae. This is the anterior part. So that's going to be the front part of a vertebrae. The part that's in the back, right over here, is the posterior part. You can feel all those bumps, right? This is what we call the spinous process. What's the function of the spinous process right here? It's for?
Muscle attachment.
Anytime you hear process, you just automatically want to say muscle attachment. Here's a transverse processes here and here. What's the function of these transverse processes? Muscle attachment as well, right? So all of the muscles in your back, and you have hundreds of muscles in your back that attach to all of these different spinous and transverse processes of your vertebrae, right, that allow you to stand erect. Okay, so this one right here is a cervical vertebrae, and we know it's cervical because I see some holes in the transverse processes. And so we call that the transverse foramen. So there's an artery that goes through those holes that are going to take blood all the way up to your brain through these transverse processes. So we call that the vertebral artery. Very important artery bringing blood to your brain. Almost impossible to live without those right there. And notice the spinous process. Does it end in just one point or does it look like it has 2 points? It's got 2. We call that a bifid spinous process. That's a nice distinguishing feature of all cervical vertebrae. They have 2, or they have a bifid spinous process, and they have these transverse foramina. When we look at a thoracic vertebrae, what can you tell me about the transverse foramina, or the transverse foramen on one side? Do you see one there?
No.
Nope, it's gone. Okay, because that's a characteristic of a cervical vertebrae only. A thoracic vertebrae, however, has some facets on this transverse process here and here. And that's an articulation for a rib. Because what do you have in your thoracic region? You have ribs. And so ribs attach to thoracic vertebrae. And how many thoracic vertebrae did we say that we have?
12.
We have 12. Guess what? How many pairs of ribs do we have? Okay. From superior to inferior, we have actually 12 ribs. Because every rib has got attached to a thoracic vertebrae. A rib can't attach to a cervical. A rib can't attach to a lumbar. Because if it did, then it would be what? It would be a thoracic vertebrae. So the number of pairs of ribs that you have really determines how many thoracic vertebrae you have. And they have these articulations for the ribs. The lumbar vertebrae don't have ribs on them. They're massive, they're huge, the body is huge because your whole body weight is being supported by that part of the vertebrae right here. Okay, so not only is a vertebrae important because it supports your body weight, and there's muscles attached to it for posture and for motion. But look at this big hole right here in all of the vertebrae. We call that the vertebral foramen. What's going through this vertebral foramen? It's a function of a foramen is a passageway for something, and you should be aware of what's going through this foramen right here. That is the spinal cord. It's a major part of your central nervous system. And all the vertebrae line up so that this vertebral foramen lines up so that the spinal cord runs all the way from your brain down into your lumbar region right here. And so the vertebrae, when they line up, protect the spinal cord. Even though they're just individual bones, it forms a nice armor plating of everything. Okay, so now we know some little characteristics of the different kinds of vertebrae. Let's look at C1 and C2. C1 goes by the name of the atlas. Who can tell me about Atlas? What is Atlas? That's a mythological figure. That's a god. Yeah, that's the god that's supposedly holding up the world, right? That's Atlas. And C1 is holding up what? The skull. Right, and so it's kind of like the mythological god holding up the whole world, because your skull kind of reminded somebody of a globe at one time. Right, so C1 and Atlas are the same. Notice that it does not have a body, a vertebral body. And it's a kind of a thin vertebrae, and as a result of that, it's probably more prone to fracture than most other kinds of vertebrae. Also, the joint between C1 and where does it articulate on the skull? What bone does it match up with on the skull? Can anybody kind of picture about where that C1 is? Let's see if I can get a picture. All right, so here's the skull. And C1 is going to be right in this region here. It's articulating with this bone. That is the occipital bone, and there's a big hole in the occipital bone right here that matches up with the vertebral foramen of C1. That hole is called the foramen magnum of the occipital bone. That's where the spinal cord goes through. All right, so what kind of motion is allowed between C1 and the occipital bone? What can you do with your neck? Yeah, you can kind of rock it from side to side. Okay, you can rotate. Right, that's like my least favorite answer in the world. But what else can you do? You can flex and extend. You can rock your head backwards and forwards. Right, that's like my favorite answer in the world. What's that motion called? That's the yes motion. Okay. All right, so the joint between the occipital bone and C1 allows you to rock your head back and forth like this, all right, and maybe a little bit from side to side, but not rotation. If the joint between C1 and occipital bone rotates, then usually C1 will fracture. And that could be devastating, of course, if that bone fragment goes into the spinal cord, and then you'll be paralyzed from that point down forever. We don't know how to heal that particular kind of injury yet. Okay? So the motion between C1 and occipital is what we call the yes motion. But now let's look at C2. What does C2 look like? I see it does have a nice body right here. There's that nice bifid spinous process. But if we look from the side, we have this bone that's sticking up right here. We call that the dens or the odontoid process. And this den sticks up right in this location here of the atlas. And so that allows for a rotational kind of motion. Right? So when you rotate your head, which is what? No motion. This kind of motion is allowed not between the occipital bone and C1, but between C1 and C2 because of this dens right here. All right, so we can rotate between C1 and C2, but what happens if we try to flex and extend at this joint between C1 and C2? This dens has a tendency to fracture, to break off, and more likely than not, it's going to damage the spinal cord. All right, so that's a very dangerous kind of fracture as well. So the motions that you perform with your neck, right, are just very characteristic of these joints between the occipital bone and C1 and between C1 and C2. And, okay, you don't ever want to perform any other kind of motion at those joints because those bones have a tendency to break. Okay. And if what happens if you come upon a traumatic accident where somebody's maybe hurt their neck? What's the most important thing to do? Okay. Is certainly not move them. As a matter of fact, you might not even want to touch them unless you're trained on how to stabilize a cervical injury. Because a lot of times, because C1 is such a small bone, it can fracture, but it will be a stable fracture. Okay, it won't necessarily be dangerous. All right, as long as a person gets transported to the hospital correctly, they won't have a spinal cord injury. But if you turn somebody over or manipulate them in some way, then that fracture can proceed into the spinal cord and produce a paralysis for the rest of their life. Okay, so probably the most important thing is to just tell somebody, don't move. You know, just stay stationary until the paramedics can come and get them to the hospital. All right, so that's part of the spinal cord. Which vertebrae are those? What's the name of this one right here? That's C1, but what's the real name for it? What's another name for it? That's the atlas. And then this one over here, this is C2. What's another name for the axis? It's the axis, sorry. C2 is the axis. And which one has the dens? That's this one right here, C2, or the axis has the dens on it. Okay. So I think that's pretty good for vertebral column. And we have to talk about ribs that form the thoracic cage. Oh, you have another picture in your book, your sacrum right here. All right, that's the most inferior part of your vertebral column. All right, so the thoracic cage. So if you have 12 thoracic vertebrae, how many pairs of ribs do you have? You've got 12, because it's got to match up. And there is some individual variation. We might find somebody in here that's missing a pair of ribs, and then consequently one vertebrae right here. Somebody might have an additional one. There's some anatomic variation in the population, but it's not as pronounced as in the coccygeal region. And we name ribs like we do the vertebrae. Right, so here's rib number 1, number 2, all the way down to number 12. And the breastbone right here is what we call the sternum. The sternum has got 3 parts to it, the manubrium and the body and the xiphoid process. And is anybody CPR certified in here? Probably. A lot of folks are. And when you get a CPR certification, you learn about this little xiphoid process and actually learn about the body, because when somebody's heart isn't beating, somebody that's trained in CPR can actually help beat the person's heart even though it's not beating on their own by doing what we call what? Chest compressions, right? And we compress the person's heart and that helps pump blood to the rest of their body. And you need to do chest compressions on this big strong bone, the body of the sternum, and not the xiphoid process, which is kind of a little weak bone. Because if you do compressions on the xiphoid process, you can snap it off, and then it's going to move around inside the body, and a broken bone is very sharp. Maybe not as sharp as a razor blade, but close. And so it can lacerate the liver. And so not only is a person's heart not beating, and maybe they're not breathing, but now you've got a big hemorrhage, internal bleeding on top of it. So the important thing when you're trying to help people out in an emergency is not make their condition worse, right? So you don't do compressions on the xiphoid process right here. All right, so we talk about the ribs, number 1 through number 7 here. You see they are attached to the body of the sternum via this cartilage. We call that a costal cartilage. So number 1 through 7 are what we call true ribs. And the other ribs don't attach directly to the sternum right here via costal cartilage or otherwise, and we call those false ribs. So ribs 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12 are false ribs. So can you see that the costal cartilage of rib number 8 right here doesn't go to the sternum? It actually goes where? To the costal cartilage of rib number 7. So number 8 doesn't go all the way to the sternum. So consequently, number 8 right here is what we call a false rib. Furthermore, the most inferior two ribs don't have any costal cartilages at all on them. So they're false ribs, but they're also different because they have no cartilage. They're completely floating. So those we call floating ribs or floaters. So floaters are false ribs, but not all false ribs are floaters, right? So 8, 9, and 10 are not floaters, though they are false ribs because they don't attach to the sternum right there. Okay, so that's the thoracic cage, the number of vertebrae, and something about the sternum right there. Okay, put that right there. Let's see, what else do we got? So you know what? We're done with the axial skeleton. Now we're going to talk about the appendicular skeleton. All right, so the appendicular skeleton is made up of what? The upper limbs and the lower limbs, plus some structures that attach the limbs to the axial skeleton. And those are the girdles, the pectoral girdle for the upper appendage and the pelvic girdle for the lower appendage. So let's start with the pectoral girdle. There are two bones, the scapula and clavicle, that make up the pectoral girdle. And the posterior bone is the scapula, the anterior bone is the clavicle, and it almost fits like a girdle around our upper trunk. Not quite, because it doesn't go over the sternum right here. Okay, so here is the clavicle between the manubrium and part of the scapula, and the bone in the back, that is your scapula right here. So that's the pelvic girdle. And the scapula is held in position by a number of muscles of your back. Right, so the only joint that is holding your whole upper appendage to your axial skeleton is this joint right here. Just that one little joint between the manubrium and the clavicle. And the rest is all held in position by muscles that attach to the scapula. So those bones make up the pectoral girdle. So this is what a scapula looks like. It's a nice triangular shaped bone. It's got a nice depression right here, which sometimes we call a fossa. What's the function of a fossa? It's for, a foramen is a passageway, but a fossa is a depression for holding something. And what's being held right here is the bone of your arm, okay, which is the humerus. So the humerus articulates with the scapula right here. And the acromion process and the coracoid process help stabilize the shoulder joint because there are ligaments that go across the shoulder as well as some muscles. And, okay, I don't know if you've ever given anybody a back rub, but you can feel this nice big bony prominence right here on somebody's scapula in their back. We call that the scapular spine. And again, that's for muscle attachment. And the acromion process is for muscle attachment, and the coracoid process, that's for muscle attachment. You have a bunch of muscles that attach to the scapula that hold it in position. Okay, I think that's all I'm going to say about the scapula. But what does the scapula make up? What important skeletal feature does the scapula make up? Along with the clavicle, it makes up the pectoral girdle, the pectoral girdle that helps attach your upper appendage to your axial skeleton right here. Okay, well, let's look at a bone that makes up your arm. That's the humerus. And this is a nice condylar surface at the proximal epiphysis of the humerus. This is what articulates with the glenoid cavity of this scapula. Here's that glenoid cavity. So the head of the humerus would fit right in there like that. And it kind of looks like a ball and socket. And that is a nice ball and socket joint that gives you a lot of mobility. Okay, and we have some big processes right here. We call these tubercles. Guess what the function of these tubercles is? Is there a process? So they're just Muscle attachments. Okay, so that's the humerus. I don't think that's an exam figure. In the forearm, you have two bones. Okay, and can anybody tell me about anatomic position again? What's anatomic position? Which way are your thumbs pointing? Laterally, right? Okay, laterally. And in that position, you have two bones in your forearm. In that position, the lateral bone is going to be the radius, and the medial bone is going to be the ulna. And the ulna you're probably familiar with because of your elbow. Down over here, this big bony point right here, on the ulna is called the olecranon process. So this big bony prominence right here has a big important muscle attached to it, right, that allows for motion of your forearm. So the olecranon process on the ulna. All right, so that's it for the arm. I think, what do you have for exam figures? You have the whole skeleton. All right. So where are these bones at on the skeleton? Skeleton, skeleton. Where is that skeleton at? Come on out. Here's the skeleton. Okay, so here's an anterior view of the skeleton. And of course, we're looking at the appendicular skeleton. So here is the clavicle and the scapula in the back. In the arm, we see the humerus. And then in the forearm, we've got the radius laterally and the ulna medially. All right, and if we look at the posterior view, again, you can see the scapula in the back, the clavicle in the front just barely, and then the humerus in the arm, and the radius and the ulna in the forearm. Okay, so these are the bones that you might have to label on the test, for instance. All right, so I'm going to put the skeleton up over here. All right, that takes us to the hand. So here's a hand. Here is the radius, and here's the ulna, because you know this is the radius because it's lateral. How do you know that this is lateral over here? Because that's your thumb. Okay, there's your thumb right here, and here's your little finger. All right, now all of your fingers, your thumb and all your other fingers, are what we call digits. So your hand has digits, those are your fingers. It's made up of these bones here, but you also have some bones that make up your hand. These are the bones right here. And what else do you have? What other bones do you have? You have bones that make up your wrist. So you've got wrist bones, you've got hand bones, and you got bones that make up your digits or your fingers, for instance. Right. Okay. The bones that make up your wrist are what we call carpals. And you've got eight of them. You don't have to know the names of these eight, but you got to know that the bones that make up the wrist are called carpals. These are carpals. And has anybody broken their wrist in here? I hope not. Anybody? A couple people have? Yeah. Easy to do. You know the name of the bone that was broken? Maybe, maybe not. Usually it's this one right here. It's the scaphoid because it has this little pointy part to it right there. It has a tendency to fracture more than any of the other bones of your wrist. So if you want to remember one name of a bone, that would be a good one to remember. But otherwise, just say what? These are all carpals. They make the wrist. Then the bones that make up your hand are what we call metacarpals. And they don't have names like the carpals do. They just have numbers, starting with the metacarpal by your thumb. That's number one. And then you end up with number?
Two.
Well, okay. Yeah, it goes one, two, three. And then you stop at five because you have five digits on your hand. Okay, so this is the number five metacarpal. There's a number four metacarpal, so it's pretty easy to remember how to call these things. All right, and then when we get into the digits, we have bones that make up your fingers or your digits, and in most of your digits, you've got three, and they're called phalanges. So let's look at your ring finger right here. This is the proximal phalanx. Here's the middle phalanx, and if this is the proximal, guess which one this is? That's the distal. Distal phalanx right there. And then you would say what digits it is on. It's number what? Number four. So this is the number four proximal phalanx. So you know exactly what digit it's on and which one it is. These are all nice long bones even though they're relatively short. So digit number two, three, four, and five have three phalanges in them, proximal, middle, and distal. But look at digit number one over here. It's only got a proximal and a distal. It doesn't have a middle phalanx. So that's why you can always tell that this is the thumb right over here, because it only has two phalanges. Okay, so we're going to compare that with the foot in just a little bit. All right, so just like the upper appendage has the pectoral girdle attaching it to the axial skeleton, the lower appendage has the pelvic girdle attaching it to the axial skeleton. And what does that pelvic girdle look like? It's made up of the hip bones. All right, so here's a hip bone, and here's a hip bone over here, and you can see the sacrum in between them. Now remember that the sacrum is really part of the vertebral column, not part of the pelvic girdle. And the pelvic bone is made up of a couple other bones that have fused together, namely the ilium right here, which is the most superior part, and posterior. And then the bone in the front is what we call the pubic bone or pubis. And then the bone that we're actually sitting on, right, so it's the most inferior bone of the hip, that's what we call the ischium. So here is the ischium, and all those bones have fused together. And you can see what bone of the lower appendage articulates with the pelvic bone right here. It is the femur. And so here is a nice ball, the head of the femur inserted into the pelvic bone. So there should be a nice smooth depression within that pelvic bone to accept the head of the humerus. Head of the femur, sorry. I was looking for a slide. All right, so here we've taken apart the pelvic bone. And so this is the lateral side. This is that depression in the pelvic bone that accepts the head of the femur, thank you. And this is what we call the acetabulum right here. So the anterior bone is the pubis, and then this is the iliac crest. Iliac crest is a rough raised process on the bone. What's the function of this iliac crest? It's for muscle attachment. Here is a process right here we call the ischial tuberosity. Guess what the function of this is? Muscle attachment. Muscles of your leg, for instance, attach right here. Okay, so this bone that makes up the pelvic girdle, we call the os coxae, or a coxal bone, C-O-X-A, the coxal bone. So here we have an os coxae, here's one over here, here's one, and here's one. It's put together, so we're looking at what we call the pelvic girdle right here. And in this particular case, we're looking at a male and female. And so there's some really easy to identify differences between a male and female pelvis, right, or pubic bone. The male is a lot taller. The female is shorter. The female is wider compared to the male. But there is something, if you actually look at a skeleton, okay, you could tell from across the room. So we said this was the ilium, here's the pubic bone, and then the ischium is down over here. This right here is what we call the pubic arch that's formed when we bring the ischium and pubis together. And this joint right here is just called the pubic symphysis. Look at the pubic arch in the top diagram compared to the bottom diagram. Can you see a difference right there? Okay. So the pubic arch of the male is usually less than 90 degrees, but in the female, it's greater than 90 degrees. It's spread open. Okay, because since this is the pelvic bone, if we go through the pelvic bone, okay, we would call this the pelvic inlet, going from the top down. Going from the bottom up, we would call that the pelvic outlet. And because the pubic arch is much wider in the female, that does what? That enlarges the pelvic outlet, which is, of course, very important during what kind of process? Yeah, parturition or childbirth, right? So the little kid doesn't have to squish down quite so much to get through the birth canal. So the increase in pubic arch right here just enlarges the birth canal for parturition. Okay, something else happens during parturition, and that is this pubic arch right here. This is a fibrocartilage joint, and during parturition, that joint is dissolved away, or at least partially dissolved away, so that the pubic bones can separate, and again, that enlarges what? The birth canal. And then after parturition, what happens to that joint? It goes back together again, mostly, okay? But not exactly 100%. All right? And that happens to guys, too. When does that happen to guys? Well, it could happen to women, I suppose. All right? Does anybody ride a motorcycle in here? It's fun. But if you crash and go through the handlebars, okay, that pubic symphysis separates. And then it heals, it goes back together again too. But how does it go back together again? not exactly the way it was at the beginning. Okay, so riding motorcycles certainly can be dangerous. All right, so this is what we call the pelvic girdle. So what bone do we want to look at next? We want to look at the femur right here. All right, so what does that femur look like? So here's the femur. Here is the head of the femur. Can you remember where the head of the femur articulates? At what part of the hip bone? That's what we would call the acetabulum. Where's that acetabulum? Right here. That's where the head of the femur inserts into, just like that. And you can see a little depression within the head of the femur right here. We call that the fovea capitis. I'm getting stuck here for some reason. The fovea capitis. And there's an important ligament that goes between the head of the femur and into the acetabulum that keeps the head of the femur inserted into that socket that helps stabilize that particular joint, the hip joint. And there's also a blood vessel that goes through that ligament, through this fovea capitis right here. And what could you tell me about bone? Is it a dead tissue or a living tissue? It's a living tissue, so it's not like concrete that we have in this room. This bone is alive in us. And how long does this bone last for? Basically, about 5 years, right? And then it's rebuilt during that time. So this part of the femur, the head of the femur, is being rebuilt all the time, but it needs oxygen and nutrients from that artery that's going through this fovea capitis. And some people can actually damage that artery due to trauma, maybe an automobile accident or other kinds of trauma. And if blood doesn't get to this part of the bone, what happens to this part of the bone? It dies, right? Because living tissues need oxygen and nutrients. And then this end of the bone just dissolves away and becomes just a ragged piece of bone that's grinding up inside the acetabulum. So when that happens, what do you need? You need a hip replacement, right? So then they fashion a nice something that looks like a bone out of titanium and glue it to the rest of the femur, maybe screw it in place, and then put that in your hip bone, and now you have a nice artificial hip. Okay, so when bone dies because it loses its blood supply, we call that necrosis, bone necrosis. And that happens to some people just spontaneously, but usually it's a result of trauma. And there was a professional football player that got tackled from the side really bad, and that artery got damaged, and eventually the head of his femur dissolved away bad enough, okay, and they had to do a hip replacement on him. But this guy was such a phenomenal athlete, he not only played professional football, he played professional baseball. It's really rare to find an athlete that's so good that can play two different sports because it takes all different kinds of coordination and muscles and to do that kind of thing. And even after he had an artificial hip, he was still so good that he went back and played professional baseball. He never went back and played football because he probably wanted to protect his hip. But he could still play out in the outfield well enough, more than most humans, even with an artificial hip, because he had that necrosis of the head of the femur. Who was that? Does anybody know who that was? Somebody, yeah, somebody said. That was Bo Jackson. Okay, Bo Jackson. Did you ever meet him? No. Oh, you did. Okay. So that's actually pretty amazing. So don't forget about bone necrosis. People that actually very muscular men with big, huge, strong bones and big, huge muscles have a tendency to develop bone necrosis, even without trauma, which is kind of interesting. I don't know exactly why that happens. All right, so that's the femur. Now, in your arm, how many bones did we say were in your arm? Actually, your forearm. Sorry, your forearm. There are two. All right, so now we've gone from the thigh, which is your femur, to your leg. You're going to have two bones there as well. And those are the tibia and the fibula. All right, so you can see down at the distal parts of the tibia and fibula, that helps make up what you commonly look at as your ankle joint down over there. All right, so these are your ankle bones. Those ankle bones are processes of the fibula and tibia. We call that the malleolus. That's easy to palpate. And the tibia is easy to feel on yourself as well because it's very superficial. And if you ever bang the anterior part of your leg, right? That's the bone that kind of gets crushed. That feels real bad. It's the tibia. So you can, that's your shin bone, which you can feel right there. Okay, it's almost like a knife edge right on the surface. And the lateral bone is the fibula. So during the test, you could actually just touch your leg and see which bone is which, because you can actually feel this tibia right here. The fibula is surrounded by so much muscle that you really can't ever really feel it unless you go down to the ankle. All right, so don't forget tibia and fibula. And that takes us down to the foot, which is right here. All right, so here's the tibia. So we're looking medially at your foot. So what digit is medial on your foot? Is it your little toe or your big toe? It's your big toe, right? All right, because here's the tibia. That's the medial bone in your leg. Here is your toe right here. And remember, that's a digit. What kind of bones do you have in digits? Again, they are phalanges. So you have phalanges that make up your toes and phalanges that make up your fingers. And almost the same kind of arrangement. All right, but in the wrist, what bones make up the wrist? Those are called? In the wrist they're called? Carpals. Okay, carpals. But in the foot, we don't call them carpals, we call them tarsals. Your book says tarsus. I don't know the older edition of the book said. It says tarsals now. Ah, that's good. Okay, it's catching up to a little bit more modern terminology. So there are tarsals that make up your ankle. So carpals are wrists, tarsals are your ankle. And the couple important tarsals to be aware of, the heel bone is what we call the calcaneus. And there's a big strong tendon that inserts into the calcaneus that moves your foot around. That's called the Achilles tendon. Probably you've heard of that one before, Achilles tendon or calcaneal tendon because of this bone right here. And then the bone between the tibia and fibula that make up the major part of your ankle joint, that's called the talus. So these are all tarsals, but you might have to know the name of this one right here, calcaneus, but that's the only one. The other ones, you just have to know that they are what? Tarsals. All right, then bones of the foot per se, but not the ankle, are metatarsals, not metacarpals that make up your hand, right? So metatarsals. And then the phalanges that make up your toes or digits. So here is a top-down view of the foot. Ankle bones are tarsals. Bones of the foot are metatarsals. And again, they are just numbered 1 through 5, starting with the great toe. Okay, you could say big toe, but probably a proper terminology would be great toe. All right, big toe. So number 1, metatarsal. Number 2, number 3, number 4, number 5, metatarsal. And how would you know if I were to say number 5 metatarsal, how would you know that's the foot and not the hand? Because in the hand, that would be a number 5 metacarpal. Right, metacarpal. Okay. Now the phalanges have the same nomenclature as the hand. You would see that on this fifth digit right here, you got a proximal, middle, and distal. But for digit number 1, you only have a proximal and distal. You don't have a middle phalanx. So this is your great toe right here. All right, so hopefully you can see the difference between a hand and a foot pretty easily. Okay. So that's pretty much it for the bones of what part of the skeleton? The appendicular skeleton. Appendicular skeleton. Okay. I want to go over some motions. Actually, yeah, let's go over some motions, which is this right here. Okay. You've got some really good pictures in your book, but maybe I'll demonstrate what some of these different terms are. Flexion and extension. A lot of the terms you see right here, you see two terms that pair up with each other. That means that these motions are opposite to each other. And we call that antagonistic motion. When they're opposite to each other, that's antagonism. So, for instance, if we look at my upper appendage and my elbow right here, we see that the angle between my humerus and my forearm is about 180 degrees. And I can decrease that angle to 90 degrees and even smaller than 90 degrees. That motion of decreasing the angle is what we call flexion. So this is flexion, and if we increase the angle, that is extension. Flexion and extension are antagonistic motions, and it's produced by different muscles that are antagonistic to each other. Okay, so flexion and extension. We can decrease the angle between my thigh and my trunk, right, by what? At the hip. What is this at the hip? I'm decreasing the angle. That's flexion. So this is flexion at the hip, and then pushing my leg down like that is extension. The vertebral column. We can flex the vertebral column. If you're to bend forward like that, my cervical region is flexed. I'm bringing the angle of those bones together, right? Or standing up straight is extension, right? So flexion of the vertebral column, extension of the vertebral column. Some joints you can hyperextend by what? Going like this, tilting your head all the way back. That's hyperextension. Now, can you hyperextend your elbow? You shouldn't, because something's going to break, right? So some joints you can hyperextend, other joints you can't. Okay, abduction and adduction. Your appendages and even your digits, like your fingers, you can spread your fingers out like that, or you can bring them close together. If you bring them close together, all parallel to each other, we call that adduction, when you're adding your fingers together, adduction. Or if your arms are out to your side and you add your arms to your body, that's adduction. When you bring your arms up, that is abduction. Or when you do the Spock maneuver like this, live long and prosperous, that is what? Abduction or adduction? It's just practice, I think. I think it's just practice. If you're a piano player, you can probably do it. I guess the reason why I can do it is because I give this lecture once a semester. So I use those muscles a little bit. It's practice. All right, so spreading your fingers out, that is abduction. When you bring them together, that's adduction. So abduction, adduction, same thing with your legs or arms. All right, so this is, that is abduction, and this is adduction. Pronation and supination. These are a little bit, they're not too bad to understand, but in anatomic position, remember which way are the palms of your hands facing? Yeah, anteriorly or forward, anteriorly. But you could also move your hands so that they face posteriorly. That's a motion. Kind of almost looks like a rotation, but not quite. It's what we call supination and pronation. So when you move the palms of your hands so they face posteriorly, that is pronation. All the P's kind of line up. Palms posterior, that's pronation. Right, and when the palms are moved anteriorly, we call that supination. And there's an easy way to remember that as well, because if you put your hands together like that, that makes a supo. So that's not how they named it supination, but that's just an easy trick to remember, right? So supination is when the palms are anterior. Pronation is when they are facing posteriorly. Inversion and eversion are what you can do with your ankles if you're not careful. And do I have a picture? Oh, I thought I had a picture maybe. Oh, yeah, I have some pictures. Okay. Here's flexion, here's extension, here's flexion of the wrist, extension of the wrist, hyperextension of the wrist. Abduction and adduction. Okay, inversion and eversion. So where's the lateral side of your foot? That's your little toe right here. Here's the medial side. So if you twist your ankle to where you're standing on your lateral malleolus right here, all right, if you bend like that, that's inversion. Your ankle joint's not very strong in that direction. When people sprain their ankle, it's usually that kind of motion. When you invert. Eversion is the other way, when you try to stand on your medial malleolus. That's difficult to do. There's a lot of strength in the joint. It's rare to sprain your ankle doing that. But if you ever do sprain an ankle with an eversion, it is much more dangerous. It's harder to heal from that particular kind of injury. What else do we have? inversion, eversion. Okay. Plantar flexion, dorsiflexion. That's a good one to know. It has to do with your foot. Okay. So here's your foot, and here's a person standing normally. If you lift your toes up off the ground, we call that dorsiflexion. When you point your toes into the ground, that is plantar flexion. Okay, by moving here at the ankle. So when you're walking, all right, just as you're about ready to lift your foot up off the ground, what are you doing to your foot? Are you dorsiflexing or plantar flexing? Just as you're about ready to lift up. As you're about ready to lift up, you are lifting your toes up off the ground. So you are actually dorsiflexing. Because if you don't lift your toes up off the ground, when you try to take a step, what's going to happen? You're going to rub your toes on the ground, and you could trip or fall as a result of that, right? So dorsiflexion is a real important motion. And when do you plantar flex? That's when you're pushing off, right? When you're pushing off, propelling yourself forward. Okay, so it used to be doctors would look at your shoes all the time. When you go see a doctor, why would they look at your shoes? Okay, because, for instance, if a person couldn't dorsiflex, the tips of their shoes would wear out, and there'd be a little bald spot because they'd be dragging the tip of their shoe across the ground. And that's a nice sign for a spinal cord injury. So that's a nice, easy way to tell. When we get to the nervous system, you might see why that is. All right, so knowing these motions is pretty important. All right, rotation. What the heck is rotation? We get just two more of these things. Rotation of your head would be, here would be a lateral rotation. Here is a right lateral rotation, left lateral rotation. What two bones allow you to rotate your neck or your head? Between C1 and C2. C1 and C2, not between C1 and occipital bone. Right, between C1 and C2. That's between the atlas and the axis. And then, so that's a rotation, but also, for instance, your humerus can rotate. A good way to think of rotation of your humerus is if you flex your elbow or your forearm, okay, and then move your forearm to midline, your humerus is rotating. Or this is a lateral rotation, this is a medial rotation. And that could be used sometimes to diagnose a rotator cuff injury. Okay, anybody ever hear of rotator cuff injury? Yeah, rotator cuff, it has to do with a bunch of muscles that go across the shoulder. Well, somebody with a rotator cuff injury can't put any pressure on a lateral rotation of the humerus like this. So you just have somebody flex at the elbow and see if they can resist that pressure. All right, and if they can, no rotator cuff, but if they kind of scream in agony, then that would be a rotator cuff injury. And then lastly, circumduction. You can do with your hip and your shoulder joint, which is a windmill motion. So it's complicated. It's flexion, extension, abduction, adduction, all in one kind of motion. Okay, that circumduction is what? A windmill motion that you can do with your shoulder and also your hip. All right, so motions of the skeletal system are kind of fun to look at. And I don't know if those are exam figures or not. They're not. Okay, but, okay, they're not. Good. Yeah, hopefully you've looked at the figures. Okay, so any questions? You need a Scantron next time? Good eraser? And a pencil.